I would definitely put it in the top 10.
It's so good.
A lot more thought has gone into the story.
I think it's awesome.
This is a spy movie disguised as a superhero movie.
There's such clear-cut good and bad.
It's definitely got some horrific elements.
Well, once we go there, you're just going to throw physics out the window.
That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
This is like the Fast Times at Ridgemont High of the fantasy world. Yep. Wow. That was something else. Now, kids, your homework tonight is to go home and watch this on television.
At that point in the script, you're actually rooting for her.
And I am just giggling maniacally through the whole thing.
When slashers came home.
I love that they just throw you in there and say, okay, find your way out. A lot of people don't like horror movies.
It's a coming of age, not a horror movie.
But I still love it because it's a slice of life, and I'm okay with that. Tim really wants to like this movie.
I loved the production design.
I wanted more from this movie.
Your reality is not what you think it is.
Oh my God, am I destroying our podcast?
This is your world. The train saved humanity.
The engine lasts forever.
The population must always be kept in balance.
Passengers, eternal order flows from the sacred engine. We must occupy our preordained position. I belong to the front. You belong to the tail. Know your place. Keep your place.
We take the engine, and we control the world.
When is the time?
Soon.
Precisely 74% of you shall die.
This is your destiny.
Hello, hello, hello out there in YouTube and podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that often lift and or separate them from the average genre fare. Are you new to us? Well, David and I have been talking about movies since the dawn of time, and we decided that it might be time for us to share our ramblings with you. And when I say ramblings, I do mean ramblings, because we are unscripted, and we tend to stammer and say, but hopefully we're trying to edit some of that out so it doesn't bother you too much in post. For those of you coming back, obviously it didn't bother you, and you are here because you enjoy our ramblings. David is my co-host and good friend, and he is with me today in the snowy wilderness. David, yes. How are you doing?
So cold here, getting ready for Turkey Day and all that, because this is November, right?
I mean, it is November.
Yeah, sort of thing.
The date is the 3rd. We are in November.
Yeah. Normally we break the ice before we get into the topic of the week, just talking about what we've done in our spare time, infinite spare time, and what we may have done that's genre specific or genre related. And when I know there's a whole memes and subculture and everything, TikToks or whatever, about people who get on Netflix or Hulu or Amazon Prime and start scrolling for something to watch, and they end up spending 90 minutes or 2 hours looking for something and watching trailers rather than watching a movie. And of course, I'm sure you and I do that occasionally. I know I do. But I just stumbled upon a movie and I had never heard of it before. And I'm sure when I mention it, you'll go, oh yeah, I watched that. But anyway, I had never heard of it before and never seen it. So I watched it and then did a little bit of research on it and everything else. It was a movie that came out in 2012 called Hitchcock, that starred Anthony Hopkins, Helen Mirren, and Scarlett Johansson.
I have heard of it, but I have not seen it.
I had never even heard of it before. Mm-hmm. And I love all three of those actors. Mm-hmm. So it was very interesting. So I watched the whole thing. It's basically the plot essentially is it's the story of Hitchcock trying to come up with the idea for Psycho, and then Psycho, the filming of it and then the success of it sort of thing. And it's kind of, the trailer is kind of misleading. The trailer for it seems to be that it's going to be very Psycho focused. And the poster even has him and Helen Mirren, who plays his wife. She Helen Mirren's role is the, what's her name?
Forgot her name, but she, what's that?
Alma.
Alma. She was a part of a lot of his films as far as like behind
the scenes. Well, she was essentially his muse. Mm-hmm. I mean, for lack of a better word, she was also a great editor, a great screenwriter. So she contributed a lot more than I think a lot of people think. And I think that also led to the fact that they were married for like 50 freaking years, even though there were rumors of affairs and rumors of lusting after leading ladies and stuff like that. Anyway, this movie focuses much more on that. It focuses much more on their relationship and the importance of Alma in his life and everything else. But it has a subplot, which is kind of interesting, that I really feel they kind of screwed up because it could have been cool. It starts with Ed Gein killing his brother.
Oh.
You know, with these two farmers out in the woods and da-da-da-da. And he goes, Mama's getting real sick and all this kind of stuff. He goes, don't talk about Mama and blah-blah-blah. And he goes, and it, the camera, kind of, because they're both like digging a trench or something, or digging in the field kind of thing. And it's showing both of them. And then it just pans over to the brother. And he goes, well, now, Ed, I got to tell you, we need to think about something. Maybe we need to just get rid of Mama and maybe put her in a home. And all of a sudden, a shovel goes, boom, and hits him right on the back. And anyway, so the character of Ed Gein will show up at different times in the movie. Hitchcock will be in, like in his study. And he'll look up and Ed will be standing in the corner with the hat down and the plaid jacket and everything. And he's going, yeah, you'll never get it right. Nope, not the way I see it. And everything else. And he's going, Ed, leave me alone tonight. Just leave me alone. And so it's very interesting that Ed becomes like this haunting voice in his head.
It's also got Danny Houston and Toni Collette in it.
Oh, yeah.
Cast
is great. But they don't play up that subplot enough, in my opinion. It needs to be a little bit more of that.
Of the Gein stuff?
Yeah, of Hitchcock essentially being haunted by the fact of you're only as good as your last movie, and this one's, what's this one going to be? And he put up his own money for Psycho. We all know that story, that he's the one that fronted it. The studio said they weren't going to make it, and they actually did a lot of stuff to try to sabotage him.
Oh, yeah.
And he put up.
Well, it was his version of a B movie, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it has scenes in it I know you would like and really appreciate it. However, just as a negative, because you know me, no. But it's.
Mr. Critic.
I don't think Hopkins does as well as I've seen him before.
Okay.
I don't think this is his best role in playing this part. He's decent. But Helen Mirren is extraordinary in it. And Scarlett Johansson is very good in it. She plays Grace Kelly. Or not Grace Kelly, Janet.
Janet Lee. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you would enjoy it. And I think Dennis would like it too. It's not scary, but it's some really cool behind the scenes, how this worked, and a lot of interpersonal relationship stuff. The three or four scenes of Hitchcock at the, this was before the Hayes Commission, really got, or before the, it was with the Hayes Commission before the ratings system started, but him going in front of the censorship board like two or three times is great. And shoot, it's got a funny name. Who plays Red on that 70s show? Kurtwood Smith.
I don't know.
You know, the actor, balding and glasses. I mean, you would know him if you saw him.
Yeah, he was in that short from the 80s, about that time travel short.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was him.
I can't think of his name, but yeah.
He was also in RoboCop. And
Right. We've talked about him before.
He plays the head of the censorship commission. And there's this one cut where they've had this huge, huge, big, huge relationship scene, and suddenly it cuts to him and it's a close-up and he goes, I distinctly saw a breast in that shot, Mr. Hitchcock. and just cuts, and Hitch is sitting back and everything else. He goes, well, that's of course the power of suggestion in cinema.
That's funny.
Anyway, I watched Hitchcock, and it's well worth a watch, especially if you like Hitchcock, if you like horror, if you like Psycho, any of that.
Yeah, I would be interested in that for the cast alone.
Yeah, so it was good.
Well, I did something vastly different, even though it has a cast that's very memorable. I decided, since we're in this cold world, that we needed a little warming, and I watched a 1981 movie called The Burning.
The Burning?
Yeah. Do you not remember this movie?
Not at all.
Okay. It came out in 1981. It is a sheer copycat money grab of the Friday the 13th era, because it came out roughly a year after Friday the 13th. Okay. And other slasher films that followed, well, that came and followed. It has a wild pedigree, and it gets really good ratings, but it's not that great.
Okay.
It's directed by a guy named Tony Malam. He's not really done anything of note. He's British, which I found interesting. However, guess who wrote and produced this movie?
I have no idea.
Harvey Weinstein.
Well,
it was the first movie that brought the Weinsteins into filmmaking.
Huh.
And they decided they were going to make cash off a popular trend, and they involved their mother, Miriam Weinstein, who is also a production assistant on the film.
Okay.
Another person that is very renowned. Here we go. Another renowned person that's involved with this, that I think it always was on my radar because of this in my music background. Richard Wakeman did the music for this. He is the pianist organist for Yes.
Yes. Okay. I'm thinking Alan Parsons for some reason, but it's Yes.
Very well known keyboardist. I don't think he did many movies, very much like when Jimmy Page did those Death Wish movies. They're both rock stars that kind of dabbled into soundtracks. Yep. But that's another reason why this movie is on the board as far as notoriety. Tom Savini did the effects for this movie. However, he not only did the effects, he was asked to redirect the ending, as the Weinsteins were not happy with Malam's work. So he's an unofficial director on this movie as well.
Hmm. Okay.
The cast features the cinematic debuts of three people. Jason Alexander.
Okay.
Fisher Stevens.
Okay.
He was at one time married to Michelle Pfeiffer, I believe. Anyway, but he's an actor too.
Kirstie Alley, but yeah. Okay, go ahead.
You'd recognize him. And yep. Holly Hunter.
Mm.
All three of them are in this movie as camp counselors, basically, because they're at a camp. It's very much like Friday the 13th. A synopsis is, a janitor at a summer camp is accidentally burned severely from a prank. Ooh. Years later, he is returned from an institute and returns to the camp with a pair of hedge clippers to take revenge on the campers. This movie gets 83% on Rotten Tomatoes. That's a little high. I'd give it a 75 for its pedigree, but it drones on and on and on. Attempting suspense with like very little payoff in some scenes. The highest rating for a Friday the 13th franchise is the very first one. It comes in at 67%. And I think those movies are much better at building suspense and the payoff than this movie. So I would think you would flip that. This should be 67 and Friday the 13th should be 83 or something. But that's my opinion. So, yeah, that's what I did. Wanted to offer you a little segue there, too, as far as the producers of the film.
That's right. I mean, that was going to be my segue, is Harvey Weinstein, notorious man now, currently, but in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, he was pretty big and pretty powerful.
I mean, he basically put Tarantino on the map.
Yep. And essentially created his own studio in a non-studio world at the time, kind of thing. I mean, he was God Emperor of L.A. for a while.
Yeah, unfortunately.
As far as what he picked and chose and did and everything else. And one of the ones that His company produced, and he had personal stake in too, because he had a lot of arguments with the director, was the movie we're covering today, which is 2013's Snowpiercer. It's directed by Bong Joon-ho, who we covered when we did The Host a few seasons back. Mm-hmm. He also got a lot of notoriety when he won an Oscar for Parasite, of course. But even before then, did he do Train to Busan?
No.
I didn't look that up.
No, that's a different director. Yeah. He did that new one you talked about not too long ago called Mickey 17.
Mickey 17, yeah, came out last year or earlier this year, yeah.
It's a clone movie.
It stars Chris Evans, Jamie Bell, Tilda Swinton, several others that we'll go through when we go through the cast and all of that. It's based on a French graphic novel that Joon-ho had seen. And basically, story in an extremely small nutshell is this is a future dystopian world sometime after 2014, since that's when the apocalypse hits the Earth, essentially, and you find out in newsreels. But essentially, climate change has totally decimated life on Earth. So everything is dead, everything is frozen, everything is snow-covered, all of that, except for one life, humanity-preserving train, this super train that this industrial billionaire had the concept of. And it is a train that circles the globe in 365 days and is totally connected and very long and eternally powered or perpetually powered somehow. And
a self-sustaining.
Yeah, a self-sustaining train that travels around the world. And that's the setting for the movie. The story actually follows Chris Evans' character, who comes from the tail section. They're basically the dregs of society, the homeless, the oppressed, the peasants, the workers, all of that. And as they slowly try to stage a revolt, rebellion, and make their way to the engine, which is at the very front of the train, naturally, and speak to or talk to at least the guy who is running the train, the same industrialist who came up with the idea to begin with 17 years ago, and hopefully get some class equity in the struggle that they're doing. Had you seen this movie before?
I have. I saw it back in 2013 when it came out on DVD.
Okay.
Roughly around that time. It may have been streaming, actually.
Yeah.
Because then we were probably streaming movies. And I dislike this movie for different reasons than you, I'm pretty sure. I've mentioned this in the past when we did 1984. I'm just not a fan of dystopic movies. They kind of bore me.
But you like some of them.
I like apocalyptic movies. I like post-apocalyptic movies where there's usually some kind of threat, like zombies or something. To me, there's a difference. The dystopian movies are more societal. Apocalyptic movies are a little bit more thrilling.
I think that's right. And I think you're totally correct about that. And you've actually said that before.
I have.
You don't really enjoy the.
I mean, I know there's really big gaps in logic in this movie, because Dennis told me to tell you that he would like to thank you for taking 2 hours of his life away for hate watching this movie just because he wanted to see what happened at the end. And then he went to bed 15 minutes before it was over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's like, yeah, you tell David that. Thanks for the hate watch.
Yeah, well, it definitely is. And anybody who listens to us regularly or follows us and everything else knows I've mentioned this two or three times, mostly because as the science fiction guy and trying to put together lists of science fiction films and influence of science fiction films and things like that, this movie keeps freaking coming up on people's lists. And I don't get it. I just don't understand it. And I even have, it's in bold caps on my notes here where I said, I don't, well, I'm going to find it. I keep feeling like I'm missing some huge sociological commentary that I should be getting, like a Dante reference or some weird Korean caste myth that I don't know, themes of religion, politics, caste system, society, indoctrination, all that kind of stuff. I don't get it. What am I missing? And it makes me feel stupid. But I just.
Well, I mean, it's a metaphor for classist system.
Okay.
That doesn't go over my head at all. It's quite clear, the poor in the back, the richer in the front. It's a capitalist society.
They're watching Gattaca. Okay, that's a caste society too. Actually,
hit a button, your voice went loud all of a sudden.
It did?
Yeah. I don't know, but you're loud and tinny.
Pause.
Okay, it stopped. Okay.
That better?
Yeah, better. I don't know what you did, but okay.
Anyway, I'd rather watch Gattaca. And actually, a better example that I have, it's a key jump or whatever, is like Animal Farm. Animal Farm is sociological sort of fantasy dystopia, so to speak, but it stays true to what it is. I mean, they're freaking animals that can talk and they have their society, and we buy that from the first chapter and it always works through it. And they don't have these huge, ginormous plot holes of stupidity halfway through my story that pull me out of the entire story. I cannot even appreciate Chris Evans' incredible speech and breakdown near the end of this because I've been so frustrated with the rest of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sorry to anybody out there that likes Snowpiercer. I would love for you to tell me why you like this movie and or think this movie needs to be in a top 10 list of best science fiction movies of the 20th century or yada yada and all this crap that I keep seeing coming up, because that's one of the reasons I added it this year, because I finally had to get this cathartic out of, no, this movie is not good. It's not a good movie. So.
Well, and I mean, we'll get into it in scenes, but I was going to talk a little bit about the glaring impossibilities or practicalities or whatever. But I wanted to say a little bit about Bong and his writer. Bong is known for the crime thriller Memories of Murder. He also did the monster movie we covered, The Host. He did this movie, and then he did the Oscar-winning Parasite. And the reason these films are notable is that they are the four highest grossing films in South Korea. So one director has directed the biggest movies basically in South Korea. Some of these are now partially English language films, like this one. This one you can't even tell really has a South Korean background, other than the fact that it does star one of his regulars.
First English-speaking film, as far as first.
Now, I've got that Kelly Masterson, the writer of the screenplay, that is, I think, not the graphic novel, was a former Franciscan brother who left the seminary just sort of his ordination to pursue a career in the theater. His award-winning play, Touch, was produced off-Broadway in 1987 and brought Kelly to New York. His plays have been produced throughout the country in regional theaters, including Dare Not Speak Its Name, which won Outstanding Play by the Connecticut Critics. He has also had several New York and Los Angeles productions, including Against the Rising Sea, Armageddon, North Dakota, True Story, and The Word Is Out, which won the Critics' Choice Samuel French Award. So this guy is like, I thought you would be into that because of all the theater that this guy that wrote this screenplay, and he was a Franciscan monk, for lack of a better word, and left the seminary. It's very strange. There's nothing really that religious in this movie, though. Do you see that?
No.
No, it's more political.
Very much political.
Anyway, I found that interesting. I thought you would too.
I did. And I love the fact that, I mean, there's obviously a theatricality to the
set.
Presentation, to the characters, to the structure.
Mm.
it's just, there's something to be said for willing suspension of disbelief and, or lack thereof, mm-hmm. sort of thing. I cannot get past the glaring loopholes in this movie to appreciate what they're trying to say by metaphor, and the fact that I don't really understand what they're trying to say at the end. There is no, in classic storytelling, either the hero undergoes some kind of transformation by the end, or the villain is thwarted or has a realization, has a change of heart, anything like that. Mm-hmm. Neither of those things happen in this story. The secondary the secondary character blows a hole in it, killing himself, the hero, and the villain, and leaving his sister, who is a trainee, meaning born in the past 18 years, and a little boy who suddenly has a tailored fur coat that came from freaking nowhere, and boots and everything else, and they get off and say hi to a polar bear, and that's the ending. And I'm not sure what he meant to say. Am I missing some kind of great white hope or something weird in there? I don't know. That's why this movie frustrates me.
Well, I guess it's satisfying enough that they don't freeze to death. I don't know. Instantly.
I just think there are so many better dystopian movies made that even those that have allegorical sort of things, Clockwork Orange or
Hunger
District
Games.
9 or whatever, that are so much better than this movie. Pan's Labyrinth is a great metaphor movie that is much better.
Yeah. It's a little more fantastical, so they get away with some of the slips because it's a fantasy world. This is supposed to be reality, and a lot of glaring things. Just Dennis could not get past the aquarium. He was like, no
freaking way. On a train that actually, they just had a whole sequence where it's busting through snowdrifts and ice falls.
Right.
And that aquarium's going to survive that?
Yeah.
Hell no.
No, it's like they took a fantasy, dystopian, political, sociodrama and combined it with Speed. It just doesn't have Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock in it. Because everything that train does is against, well, gravity. And that's exactly what Speed is, too, if you've ever seen that movie.
Yep.
That's actually a pretty good key.
My big suggestion for this would have been if this had been an underground tunnel and maybe come up for a couple of the apocalyptic scenes, like the anniversary scene or the bridge scene or something like that,
yeah,
it might have been a bit more believable because there's so much, I can't change the laws of physics, and yet they do. They don't explain anything. They don't explain how these, so much. They don't explain so much. The basic thing of they don't explain how railroad tracks require maintenance because you'll get tree falls or ice falls or snow piles or something, or
right,
they'll just fall apart. Bridges require constant maintenance and upkeep. And a train sits on a track, not attached to a track. If they said from the very beginning, this is like electromagnetic and like we've seen roller coasters with the dual sets of wheels, so it can't move, the track's in the middle, and you got two sets here and two sets here, and that train car will not come off of that track. It will be attached to it. If they said that, that'd be great, but then you couldn't have all those scenes where it's like teetering over, defying physics, and then falling back. And you go, no, hell no.
It's suspense.
No, there's no suspense. No suspense at all. That's the other thing about this movie. I don't think it's well-paced or well-told from a storytelling standpoint.
Well, it's kind of hard to tell a story in a train compartment. It's just
tube?
The set is a long tube, basically.
Yep.
Scenes?
None. I don't have any scenes. No.
Oh, I have a scene.
I mean, I think if you're going to talk about Snowpiercer and even a fan of it or whatever, they'll mention the classroom scene, they'll mention, of course, the scene at the end when you find out who the creator is and that whole scene. And they'll probably mention the revelation of the first Tilda Swinton scene, the punishment for insurrection scene.
That's the scene that sticks out to me. That involves the, I can't think of his name. He was in Trainspotting. The actor was.
Oh, that plays the guy with the arm? I mean, the guy that loses his arm?
Yeah, Ewan Bremmer is his name. And they make him stick his arm outside the compartment in a little hole. And it freezes, basically, and they break it off. That scene sticks to me because that's pretty terrifying.
And this is obviously a punishment that they've developed over the 17 years because there's special equipment for that.
Right.
So
it's like a cuff they put on his bicep, and then they stick it in and lock it into the hole that's already cut to fit it in the
And it looks train. Like they could do that to anything, any limb.
Yeah.
And obviously have, because there's also that cadre of people that you only see in a couple of scenes, but all of them have limbs
missing parts, including John Hurt.
Yes. But we know a backstory with him later on, except he gets an umbrella arm. I mean, come on. Most people don't get that kind of thing. Yeah, that scene is great for Tilda Swinton. It is oppressive to show the whole, I mean, she sets up the whole metaphor for the society.
Right. She is the face of society.
And the fact that, yeah, that control and balance are the most important thing, sort of thing. And she's eccentric and weird and crazy, and that works. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially reinforced later on with the Allison Pill character in the classroom scene, where it's just all of this indoctrination of the children sort of thing, which again, like I said, is a memorable scene. And of course the last scene with Wilford, the train creator.
With Ed Harris, but also in particular when they open up that floor panel and little Timmy's down there making the train work.
Yeah.
That's very memorable.
And if little Timmy's down there, why did the other kid suddenly crawl out of a side compartment and then go up into the other part and go in there? We don't even know what that means. But it happens.
Yeah.
So, yeah. There is so much in this story that I just go, okay, no one said that, no one questioned the fact that this may not make sense? Or are we supposed to let the whole concept flow over us and accept it? I mean, my watch notes are lengthy of just what.
Yeah, we can move on if you want to cast. I was trying to find, I'm looking up something I can't find. It's a key. I'll mention it to you, maybe you'll remember it. Anyway, this cast is incredible. I mean, there are a lot of people in this movie that every time you turn around you see someone you know.
Even if you don't know their name, you know that face.
Yeah. And before I even get started, two people purportedly auditioned for this film that are not in it. And they were Jake Gyllenhaal and Dustin Hoffman, which I'm like, why would they have to audition? To me, I don't think they would have to audition. But anyway, I could see either one of them. I could see them in the two parts that Chris Evans and John Hurt played. Easy.
Oh, yeah. Easy.
Mm-hmm. But Chris Evans is the lead. He is Captain America himself, quite obviously trying to distance himself from superhero movies by wearing bulky clothing and not looking like Joe Action Hero. He's actually very good in it. He's a good actor. Mm-hmm. However, there were other people that were considered for this role, including Jake Gyllenhaal, which I mentioned. The other two are other superheroes. One was Michael Fassbender. And one was Tom Hiddleston. But after it all came down to Chris got the part. The main Korean actor that is in this movie, that is in all of Bong Joon-ho's movies, is Song Kang-ho. And he, we saw in The Host. He is the father in The Host. And the little girl that's in this movie, or actually, should I say the young woman in this movie, is actually the little girl from The Host. So they are basically...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they are father and daughter in both movies.
Okay.
However, Song has gone on to do other ones, all of Bong's, including Parasite. But I thought that was interesting that they cast the same father-daughter team. Ed Harris plays Wilford.
Wilford.
And we, of course, know him from episodes past, including most recently Creepshow a few years back. We did that around Christmas. And then we did The Abyss on your side of the sci-fi world. Mm-hmm.
And I just watched him, as a side note, in Apollo 13 just a few weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I just, on a side note, he's been married to Amy Madigan since 1983. I did not know that. They've been together a long time.
Well, he's the man in black in Westworld, too, so it works really well.
Mm-hmm. Bong could not find the perfect actor for Wilford, so producer Park Chan-wook, who is also a big Korean director, by the way, recommended Ed Harris.
Okay.
And that's how he got the role.
That's good. Good choice.
Yeah. John Hurt plays Gilliam, who is obviously a former partner, like engineering partner with Wilford. We know him, of course, from Alien. He's the famous chestburster scene. He was in The Elephant Man. And most recently, we saw him in yet another dystopian movie I'm not a big fan of, 1984.
Yeah.
It's like, also, John, what is it with the dystopian movies?
He also did Elephant Man, which is amazing.
Right, right. He's great in everything. I mean, I have always liked him. I was shocked to discover that he died. I forgot. He died like in 2017. But yeah, he's been dead for a little while. Tilda Swinton plays Mason. She is, like we said, the face of society that keeps coming back to the back to talk to the minions. We know her from a movie called We Need to Talk About Kevin, which is on my list, and I've never seen it. She first came to my attention in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe over 20 years ago as the Snow Queen or White Queen or whatever.
The White Queen, yep.
I noted that her name is Catherine Matilda Swinton. So that's where the Tilda comes from, Matilda.
Yeah, I've got in my notes, I mean, she is like the female Crispin Glover. I mean, it's not that I think that any of her roles are bad. They're just extremely eccentric.
I think she's a little more versatile, though, than he is.
I do think she's more versatile, but yeah. I'm talking about just the gist I get from them. When I see their films, I go, okay, that was a choice you made. Sure, I guess.
Okay. Like those teeth.
Well, I saw in my research, she was in the makeup chair for 3.5 hours.
She looks weird. That's for sure.
But like in the Marvelverse, she's totally bald and plays she's in Doctor Strange.
Yes. So, I also know her from an independent movie in the 90s, I think, called Orlando, which was a very trans fluid movie where she plays, it's a Virginia Woolf story, if I'm not mistaken, where she plays both male and female in it. Anyway, Bong wrote this part with John C. Reilly in mind, then adapted the character for Tilda Swinton, intentionally leaving the lines of Mason being referred to in the masculine form in the script, which kind of show up in the movie. So I guess he wanted her to be butch. I don't know. Speaking of trans fluidity.
Or powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I think
I was just going to say, the only reason she's powerful is because of the people behind her, but...
No, I mean, what she's saying is powerful. The writing is powerful and emotive and everything about how this is a foot. You are the foot. I am the head. You've got to understand these things. If I think she had to force it and be eccentric and be weird and different about it, as opposed to, I mean, I could hear Reilly doing that and it having like a menace underneath it that we don't understand. And it would be a lot, to me, better, more effective. Because this nice, affable actor we're used to and character kind of thing is saying these things like, you've got to know your place and stay in it, kind of thing. I think that would have been more effective, in my opinion. Just me. But not that she's bad. It's just different.
Yeah, it's different. Jamie Bell plays Edgar. I always think that this is Tom Holland from Spider-Man. I confuse them all the time. Every time we do a movie with him in it, I'm like, isn't that Tom Holland? He's actually Billy Elliot, the kid that
they can the both dancer. Dance.
Can they really both dance?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know Tom Holland was a dancer. Okay. Uh-huh. Jamie played the Thing / Ben Grimm in the last Fantastic Four movie. And Chris Evans was Human Torch in the first Fantastic Four movie. So they have that in common.
Inspiration for you.
But Jason, Jamie started out as a dancer. He has been married to both Kate Mara and Evan Rachel Wood, but they are all divorced. So I just thought it was interesting that he had been married to those two women.
I think his performance is really strong. I think his character has the only death that I really care about in the movie.
Yeah.
I think that we find out he's part of the big double reveal at the end. We find out some stuff about him that even he didn't know, which is very confessional and cool and neat and everything else. And
well, that Chris Evans killed his mother.
He was born on the train, of course, and everything else. But I can't handle any of that because he has an Irish accent the entire time, and no one else in the frickin' train has an Irish accent, so why would he? He was born on the train. Makes no sense that he would have an accent. Makes no sense at all. And every time he spoke, I went, you actually say shite. You actually say shite, and no one else knows this dialect at all. Why would you have it?
Yeah. I mean, Tilda uses a weird voice, but
hers is just because of the teeth and the way she is enunciating and doing all of that. And John Hurt is British.
He's British.
All of them lived before the apocalypse.
Right.
So that makes sense. But if you're born on the train, you would only have the accent of the people around you.
Yeah.
So
this movie also has, I'm not done, Octavia Spencer in it as Tanya. We know her from Hidden Figures and The Help. Mainly, I think The Help's what put her on the map. However, I have a note that I did not realize until I started doing some research. She made her stage debut in Los Angeles, originating the role of Lasagna, as in lasagna. Famed writer, director Del Shores play the trials and tribulations of a trailer trash housewife. In it, she starred opposite veteran actors Beth Grant, Dale Dickey, and David Steen. And I was like, this sounds fantastic. I want to see this. And then I realized that they made a movie of it. It's called Blues for Willa Dean, and it has all three of them in it. And I've not seen that.
Well, Del Shores was that writer for a good decade.
I love Del Shores.
Of that type of comedy before they got into the James Wooten stuff that everybody does now.
Well, yeah, but he did Sordid Lives, which is one of Dennis and mine's favorite movies. He did Daddy's Dying, Who's Got the Will. So anyway, I just thought it was interesting that Octavia got started with Del Shores. She's one of his. That's just interesting to me.
And with Dale Dickey, who's from Knoxville, who I went to school with.
Well, Dale Dickey's also in the series Sordid Lives, because they did a television series of it, too. And Beth Grant, we've already talked about. She was in Donnie Darko. She is one of my favorite character actors. She's great. What is it again? The dance troupe.
Sparkle Motion. Octavia Spencer has tens and tens and tens and tens of credits. I don't know how many. I'd have to look it up.
She's in a horror movie called Ma that I've never seen. But anyway, enough about her. Then we have Ewan Bremner, whose arm gets frozen off. I recognized him. I was like, what do I know him from? He was Spud in Trainspotting, both Trainspotting movies that Danny Boyle did. Apparently, he was also in Wonder Woman and Alien vs. Predator, neither of which I've seen. But like him, Ko Ah Sung played the Yona, the daughter. I've already mentioned she was the little girl in The Host that gets snatched by the monster's tail. I don't know if you remember that scene. Love that movie. Yeah. I've actually seen that movie more than any other Bong movie. I've probably seen The Host like 5 times.
Okay.
Allison Pill played the teacher. Very familiar face. I didn't know who she was. I looked her up. She was in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And she's in Milk, the Sean Penn movie about Harvey Milk.
She also, I mean, I saw her most recently because she did 2 years on Picard. The Paramount series. And she played a doctor in that and was pretty good in it, except what they did with her in season 2, we won't go into, but it was okay. She was good. I also had in my list, she did an American Horror Story.
So maybe that's why I know her, because I probably saw it and just don't remember it because it's
probably
terrible.
One of the witches or something, or Coven or something.
I don't know about that, but all the witches were like big stars. But I probably saw her in that and just repressed it.
Yeah. She's good and she's strong, and I like this character in this one. That she's at least a compelling character.
I love that song they sing. I thought that was funny.
Halfway through, yeah.
Yeah, she plays a teacher, like a kindergarten teacher or something in first grade. There's a gay couple in this, or at least they kind of seem gay to me, that are part of the bad guy team with Tilda Swinton. They are played by Luca Pasqualino, who was on Battlestar Galactica. He played Gray. And Vlad Ivanov, who played Franco the Elder.
I thought the gay couple was Franco and Franco, the older and the younger. Wasn't that the couple?
Oh, you know, you're right. I'm sorry. Maybe it wasn't that guy. Anyway, all right. So forget Luca. He played Gray. Vlad played Franco the Elder. I don't know. I don't have a list for the other guy. He must not have had a picture. Anyway, I was like, before Dennis got into the movie, I kept mentioning later on, oh, yeah, he's pissed because his husband got killed by the young Asian woman. And he's like, husband? I'm like, well, I think they were together because they were hanging all over each other by Tilda Swinton.
Yeah.
I was like, I think they're a couple. He is a famous Romanian film and theater actor. He speaks English, French, Russian, Italian, and Romanian. He speaks like six languages. But he's really intense in this, and he makes a good bad guy, I think.
Pretty good. Yeah, he kind of comes off to me. I've got him as far as a key. I've got him. He comes off kind of like Jaws. You know, he's the big brute who really doesn't even have any lines at all and keeps coming back.
And starts doing stupid things like shooting through glass windows. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. We thought he was dead and he keeps coming back. And you're going, this makes no sense to me.
Actually, you're right. Luca played Gray. The guy that played Franco the Younger was Adnan Haskovic. So he is of Eastern European descent as well, because they both have names that sound very Eastern European. That's really all I have as far as cast. But as far as awards, this movie did really well. The Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror they do the Saturn Awards. They nominated it for Best Action Adventure Film. But that's it. It was nominated for SCADs on the circuit, but most of its 35 wins were foreign competitions that I've never heard of. So this movie did better internationally than it did in the States. And I think I read that going into it.
Okay.
It is not on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list, which I completely get. But like it won all kinds of awards in Korea, obviously. And it won other awards internationally, but it really did not win a lot domestically in the United States. So that's what I have for those two casting and awards.
Yeah.
So you say something enlightening, David.
Say something enlightening? There's nothing enlightening.
Wait, I understand the movie now.
I get it. Oh, wait, no. Because Tilda can take her teeth out. No.
It means that kids deserve to have child labor laws. Don't know.
Well, I mean, there's so... I'm frustrated by this movie, as you can
imagine. Obviously.
Because I think that it, if you're going to tell a story that even is a metaphor, then just hold true to your metaphor and make it work. And I think he's crippled from the very beginning in the fact that his apparatus makes no sense and isn't plausible. Not just the aquarium car, the fact that the cars change shape and sizes. You'll show one shot and basically six people can fit across, standing armed shoulder to shoulder, can stand across this car, and yet in other ones, three people standing abreast, and on both sides you've got windows and rooms and dentist office and everything else. And
or I think it would make a better book than it does a movie.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
I also just have struggles from the very beginning of, so this caste system developed in 17 years? In 17 years, you could get to this amount of stratification of culture. I don't know if that's sociologically possible. Maybe. I mean, look at our world from 6 years ago as opposed to now.
Well, I mean, I think the world would fall apart quick if there was a cataclysmic event or like an apocalyptic event. I mean, that's how I wrote my zombie story. It basically all falls apart in 3 weeks.
Yeah, which I don't have a problem. It's like your story.
But you're saying build something together, and I'm saying fall apart.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could understand if the metaphor of the Tailies was that we've had this sort of mythos about the rest of the train, and then as they slowly go through the train, they realize that their myth is not correct at all, that they are really wrong about it, and it's not this huge caste system, it's everybody struggling with their own things in each car or whatever kind of storyline, as opposed to this each car has its own little ecosystem sort of thing. And I don't know how anything freaking works, period. I just, but the crowd, I just don't understand.
No, it doesn't make sense. It's not really a metaphor, but it's a true to life thing that a funny little, it's not really a metaphor, but it's a story, a behind the scenes thing with Harvey Weinstein, where he and Bong Joon-ho often clashed and frequently inferred in order to demand, Harvey frequently inferred to demand his version of the film. Among many requests, the producer insisted on having the fish scene removed in favor of more action. Bong, who considered this his favorite shot in the film, was adamant. That says a lot right there. Shot.
Yeah, because it makes no sense.
Yeah, he just likes the way it looks, which is going to be kind of a theme with us next week, too. Anyway, he wanted to keep it because he told producer Weinstein that he wanted to keep the shot for a personal reason, because it was a tribute to his late father, who was a fisherman. Upon hearing this, Weinstein said that family is very important to him, so he granted Bong the right to keep the shot. In an interview, the director said, "It was a fucking lie. My dad's not a fisherman."
Tell Harvey what he wants to hear.
That was great. And I think it's funny that I mentioned the fact that not only did him and his brother do my genre topic, The Burning, but their mother was involved in it too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he is about family. Of course, he's got his own family in prison right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure he does.
Yeah, Harvey is not a good guy.
No, not at all.
No.
Never was.
But that's the only trivia bit I had. If you want to move on to Keys, or if you have any trivia.
I don't really have trivia. I just still have the same questions I have from the very beginning. I don't even know why the Tailies exist in this story. It makes no sense.
Why the what?
The Tailies, what they call the Tailies, or the people in the back, the Chris
Evans. The poor characters. People.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know why they're even, why were they even allowed on the train to begin? He gives this.
That's very elitist of you, David.
He gives this impassioned speech about, we starved for 2 months or something like that. I can't remember because I've repressed it.
And they were eating body parts.
Until they started cannibalizing. And then they suddenly develop the
a bug gelatin maker.
Yeah.
Whatever that was. Nasty.
And where do those come from? Where do the insects come from? If everything on life is, on Earth is dead, where do the insects come from? They keep feeding these people. Anyway, but so this perfect balance that he goes off on, that Wilford goes off on, and what are the numbers now? Because we need to have this. You get the impression that he allows or even creates these insurrections, he and Gilliam, because that's the other big ooh shock moment, that Gilliam's been in on this the entire time, and you're going, okay, that wasn't shocking.
But has he, or was Ed just making that up?
Right. Ambiguity. Okay, fine.
Sure. Yeah.
But you get the impression that they stage these every generation or so, every few, not generation, because it's only been 17 years, David, every few years to cull the numbers. But if they do that, then why did you have them on the train in the first place? And I read something online where somebody said, oh, well, they had to have the tailies because they produced the children for the train. No, he actually says that only happened like 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That the train started, the engine started malfunctioning, and he needed little hands and little people. So that was an adaptation. That wasn't an intent from the beginning. So I don't know why they're there. I don't know why they keep changing the physics of this. I don't know why they have the, everybody talks about these incredible action sequences that to me make no sense logically, just because, okay, so all of these guys put on night vision goggles. So you have a whole horde, literally. I mean, it looks like 50, 60, 80 people that are all in masks with night vision goggles and axes. And these people have sticks and metal rods or whatever, but no other weapons. And yet they don't kill them all. And they bring fire from the back of the train. How far back is the train? Like 17 miles? I don't know.
Yeah, it's the Olympics. It's like the, that's my key. I've got that as a key, the Olympics opening ceremony. Yeah.
They show all of these, quote, I guess it's a caste system allegory of these different cars. You know, you have, I called it the strip mall car, where you have the beauty parlor and the dentist and the office and all that. And then
that's working class.
Yeah. Then the pool car, then the sex car, then the disco car. But you never see living quarters. Where do the, so the kids have to walk through the pool and the sex car to get to class every day? Or do they live in the classroom all the time? It's just, you never see living quarters. You never see how anything works. They pass through one car that's just full of meat and chicken carcasses.
Yeah,
like a refrigerated car.
Where do, like, the where are they growing those cows?
Yeah, what the?
Dennis. It's so funny. I've never heard Dennis use the term hate watch, and I've used it frequently because of a podcast I listen to where they hate watch shows. Like they're watching as. And just like that right now. And they refer to it as hate watching and just like that because it's not Sex in the City. But anyway, yeah, Dennis was like, I can't believe I'm hate watching this, but I really want to know what's going to happen.
Yeah. And what you find out at the end is not worth it at all.
And he said, you're going to have to tell me because I'm going to bed. And he said, and I don't want a long version of it.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
That's my husband, everybody.
I could not believe. I remember watching this movie the first time because I think it was after The Host, and I really liked The Host, and I'd never really heard of it before.
Mm-hmm.
And then Snowpiercer kept coming up on all these lists, and it was the same director. So I said, oh, well, it must be good. Everybody likes it. No, it's not at all.
I've not seen Parasite, and I fully intended on watching Parasite and using it as my genre topic for the week because it's supposedly a horror movie, kind of, and I couldn't find it anywhere, so I didn't have time, and then I was like, well, I already watched The Burning, and I knew Harvey Weinstein was part of it.
Yep.
But anyway, as far as keys, I mean, the first one's obviously the graphic novel. It's called, and I don't know how to pronounce this. Do you?
I do not know how to pronounce the second word, the transpiracy.
So you can pronounce Le.
Yeah. Le Transpiracy Synergy.
I'm glad you can pronounce Lay, though.
Yeah. It's definitely the first key. You have to have it as the first key because that's what he based it on.
All right. Well, my first key is the Poseidon Adventure.
Oh, I didn't get that one. That's a great one. Oh, well, God, Tim. I did not get that at all.
It's mainly because very early in the movie, you see a guy hanging from a wheel trying to turn it. Like Gene Hackman in the Poseidon Adventure. Otherwise, it has nothing to do with the Poseidon Adventure at all. It is not a ship that is upside down.
Lead them on.
Yeah.
I have a Truman Show. Because, again, it's this one character realizing that his whole world is not what he thought it was, and he has to face Ed Harris at the end.
Oh, I've never seen that. It's...
Oh, you never seen Truman Show? Oh, you should see that.
Jim
and
Carrey.
You should definitely see Parasite is good.
Jim Carrey is very near Tom Cruise to me. I'm just not a fan. I've never been,
but I did like that movie. And he's good.
Okay. I have the third book in the Dark Tower series, The Wastelands.
Ooh, that's got a Mighty Train in it.
It's
right?
got Blaine the Mono in it, Blaine and he is a computerized train that goes across America through the wastelands, and he is kind of on a suicide mission, and he controls everything. It just a lot of the science fiction train elements are very similar to me in watching this, especially that it's very going hundreds of miles an hour and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
I have, and this actually, if you Google this, you can actually see a couple of YouTube videos or people that purport this and fans of it, but Willy Wonka.
Oh.
You've got a group of people moving through this huge structure, room by room. Every room has its own kind of personality to it. In almost every room, they lose somebody. And one person essentially makes it to the very end, and it's revealed that he had to do it in order to inherit what he's supposed to inherit. So it's
funny struggle. That you said that, because I was looking for like a Wizard of Oz allegory, and that's more to it than Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, I think it's more Alice in Wonderland than Wizard of Oz, even.
Yeah,
that whole the world's kind of askew, and you don't understand what's happening. Sort of thing.
Look at you applying metaphors to a metaphor movie.
Yeah. Willy Wonka definitely applies. Mm.
Well, I have Jason X.
Jason X
is the 10th movie in the Friday the 13th franchise.
Okay.
And that's because he takes a woman and puts her face in liquid nitrogen and freezes it and then smashes it off on a table.
Yeah.
Which is very similar to freezing a guy's arm off and then smashing it with a sledgehammer.
Okay. Yep.
It's an element. I'm not saying they have thematic similarities because Jason X takes place in outer space.
Right.
And it's on our list. I think we should cover it.
Oh my gosh. I might die. But I've got a couple of the other ones that I've got Matrix Reloaded.
Okay.
Because the whole scene with Ed Harris reminds me of the whole scene with the architect in Matrix Reloaded, where he kind of tells Neo, everything you think is wrong. What I need is for you to be the savior and do what you do best. That's why I created you to begin with, kind of thing. And Ed Harris's character is similar in what he's trying to tell Chris's character. I can't remember Chris Evans' character name, but
yeah. I have Planet of the Apes.
Planet of the Apes? Really? Okay. I'm curious.
Because of the end, when the young woman and the little boy come off of the train and it's like a brand new world, I was just waiting for them to see the Statue of Liberty.
Oh, my God.
I mean, they're new in an apocalyptic world that is clearly Earth. It's just instead of a beach, it's snow.
Wow. I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I have a series that I've only watched one episode of because I could barely get through it. But we mentioned this, I think, a year ago or so ago or whatever, because both of us like Harlan Ellison a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a series on Canadian television called The Ark, which is I think is a direct influence on this. If Bong did not see this, I would be very surprised, because basically it's a colony or generation ship that this one group of heroes goes through in every episode of the series. They're in a different part of the ship, and it's a totally different culture. So one's agrarian and farmers and blah, blah, blah. The next one's this huge religious cult that, and it's very similar to this, but makes more sense because it's been going on for generation after generation after generation, not for 17 damn years.
It's called ARK?
Called The ARK, A-R-K, yep.
And it's a Harlan Ellison story?
Yeah, he's actually created it, wrote most of the stories, produced it, and then, of course, after like four episodes, took his name off of it and said it sucked and he never wanted to be a part of it again.
Oh,
and
that sounds like Harlan.
I want to be Cordwainer or Bird or whatever his moniker is for he doesn't like it or whatever.
Interesting.
And to his credit, the episode I watched, I went, ooh, boy, this is like bad Lost in Space. This is not good. So, I mean, it came out in like the early 70s, like 73, 74, somewhere in there. So I need to watch it just to finish my archive at one point, but I haven't. But anyway, it reminded me a lot of this type of story. Okay.
I already mentioned Speed and the Olympics opening ceremonies, but I would also say...
Except by the end of the Olympics, we give everybody in the room a torch.
Yeah.
What the hell? Where did that come from? You carry those with you from the back, did you?
The Rosie Roomba has finished running.
The Rosie Roomba has finished running.
Okay, good, Rosie.
Hunger Games. But not just because it's a dystopian movie. I specifically say The Hunger Games because Tilda Swinton reminds me of Elizabeth Banks in The Hunger Games. And The Hunger Games came out the year before. So which came first, the chicken or the egg? Because Tilda wanted to be goofy. Maybe because she saw Elizabeth Banks being goofy. I don't know.
I could see that. I could definitely see that. And also I could see the comparison to you going through the different sectors, and each sector is a different caste system sort of thing.
I have another one that you're going to be shocked.
Okay. I'm ready for shocked.
Terror Train. I mean, it's all there. It's all takes place on a train, and they're doing everything in cars, except it's more realistic.
True.
It's got Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah, but Tilda Swinton is not as good as Jamie Lee Curtis.
No, anyway. She's not. And David Copperfield's in it, too.
I have.
And Ben Johnson.
An influence. Metropolis.
Okay.
Metropolis's basic story of the oppressed workers trying to stage a revolution against the elitists. So that's a very old thematic story that I think he's trying to tell here, just he doesn't do it well.
Okay. Well, I'm going to keep going to the horror side of this show.
I'll try to go more toward literature.
And I'm going to mention that the song, The Midnight, The Stars, and You, was in our last episode, The Shining.
Yes. Very memorable.
Very memorable song. So...
I have two that came from research, and they are directly attributed as influences. Bong said that he intentionally named the character Gilliam after Terry Gilliam.
Yeah.
Because he had done Brazil, and because of his eclectic style and the way he directs and world building and everything that he does.
This movie is a Terry Gilliam movie.
Oh, it is.
I mean, I would almost say, other than the graphic novel it's based on, this movie's strongest key is Terry Gilliam.
I agree with that, I think Bong Joon-ho is a much more visual cinematographer than Terry Gilliam is.
Okay.
I like Terry Gilliam. I just think...
I'm not a big fan. And since this movie reminds me of Terry Gilliam movies, that's another reason why I'm not a fan, because I'm not a big fan of Terry Gilliam movies, except for maybe 12 Monkeys, and that's it.
True. Makes sense. And then the other one I have that's directly from them was Bong Joon-ho has said that the fish scene the one that makes no freaking sense and we don't understand why or whatever.
I'm like, where's that fish come from?
Was inspired by The Godfather.
Right. Yeah, I saw that.
I saw it and I went, okay, I don't see that. I would never have done that if you hadn't said it. So I don't even know why it's in the movie to begin with, let alone what inspired it.
The only other thing I have is also from IMDb, and the three movies they specify by Terry Gilliam are Brazil, 12 Monkeys, and Zero Theorem, which I've never even heard of. Have you heard of that movie?
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
It came out in 2013. It must have just tanked.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, they're I guess, apocalyptic or dystopian movies by Terry Gilliam.
Yeah. I have, and it was just, it's just an inflect, really, or a feeling. I have George Miller and or Thunderdome.
I kind of wanted to put George Miller in there, but I couldn't really make it work.
Well, the one that really got me George Miller-wise is The Artist, who wears the headlamp, and he's always drawing people. He reminds me of Who Owns Sparta Town, of Master Blaster, or whatever.
You know what? You just put your finger on what I was trying to put my finger on, is the character played by Spud, the train spotting guy, reminds me of the guy that flies the little gyrocopter. Yeah, that's why. So it would have been Road Warrior is the one it reminds me of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Road Warrior. But also, yeah. But to me, it's Thunderdome too, because the big climax on that is on a train.
Well, and he may be in Thunderdome now that you mention it, because that character may live, I think.
I've got a literary one, meaning, and one, this was a review that I read of it, and the guy said, I just wish this had been more of like a Ray Bradbury short story, where it has its own reality and you just accept it and live with it, and then I could appreciate the movie more. Mm-hmm. And I thought, huh, thinking back, yeah. Bradbury did do that, and when even when he was trying to be metaphoric, like with Something Wicked This Way Comes or whatever, it still made sense in his reality of his world.
Again, in a book, it would work better in a book than it would in a movie.
I agree.
Because you wouldn't see the train's wheels coming off the rails and stuff, or the aquarium.
Yeah, or the aquarium, or the pools, or the... We suddenly have almost a 180-degree turnaround on the track. That was a design element you put in there, really? Or was that just there so you could shoot across from one car to another? Just anyway.
A lot of computer GI. Okay. Yeah. Is it GI? CGI. Yeah, a lot of graphics that didn't look great.
Yeah.
They look kind of cartoon. Like when they're going through the snow... ruins of cities and stuff, I was like, yeah, that doesn't look that real to me.
Yeah, no.
It's kind of cartoonish.
And
it looks like Wally.
You only have like six or eight of those in the movie. Seems like you could have done them a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah.
The last one I have is, you might like, it kind of came up to me and it was funny, and then I saw it reinforced in a review, was Marvel, of course, because once again, Chris Evans loses his best friend on a train.
So it would be Captain America.
Yeah.
The movie. Captain America. The First Avenger. Yeah.
Yeah.
I get it. I totally get it.
So.
How funny.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's all I have to say. I feel like it's all you have to say. I'm metaphored out.
Yeah. I am just, I really wish, because again, and it, I guess final thoughts would be, I think the performances in this movie are very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you can ignore the laws of physics and or all these glaring plot holes all the way through it, there's some really great speeches. There's some really interesting scenes.
It's a great idea, maybe not perfectly executed. I can forgive it a little more than David, I think, because I dislike it more for it just being dystopian. It just falls into a category of, oh, yeah, it's one of those. It's one of those. For me. For you, it's a little bit more on the logic and the scope and the whole metaphor-driven plot, I think, that you dislike it. Now, but I think it's safe to say that I've seen this movie twice. I don't know. I guess David's seen it twice now.
Mm-hmm.
And neither one of us like it very much. So we probably won't see it again. If you want to convince us otherwise, we'd love to hear why down in the comments below. Yeah. Why do you like this movie? Why do you hate this movie? I wouldn't mind hearing another reason that we didn't come up for reasons we dislike this movie either. And we'd like to thank you for joining us today. If you like what you heard, you can hear more. We have, well, now we are 8 seasons in to this show where we cover 40 movies a year, sometimes double features. You can get a complete list of all of those shows, very well organized, on our website, johnnyhasthekeys.com. Then you can go over to either YouTube or your favorite podcast platform and search for Johnny Has the Keys and the title of the film, if that makes it easier for you to find a particular film you want to see, because a lot of people don't want to see 300 episodes of us. They may want to see certain movies. Or if you like shorter bites, we've got a few little short shows that we do on YouTube, as well as Patreon, where we could really use your support if you want to reach out and help us supplement our cost in producing this show. That's the place to do it. We, over there, we do more television-oriented stuff. We've got series on The X-Files and series on Star Trek, episode by episode, as well as free stuff as well. There's free bonus shows about Dave and I, how we met, how long we've known each other. Well, a lot of Marvel stuff is over there. If you like Marvel movies, you can go see those. A lot of that stuff is free. It's all based on different tiers. You know how Patreon works. But anyway, until next week, which we're in what we're calling our apocalyptic Thanksgiving theme. So we're going to do another apocalypse movie next week before we take a short break for Turkey Day. And it is also a science fiction film, so and then we'll do something spooky for Christmas.
Sure.
All right, I'll be seeing you, David.
See you then.
All right, have a good one.